This is an ABC podcast.
Ubongia Diana, Rob Rob Meta, and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Nemblomi, Christian Rita, Aumanu Leong, and I'm coming to you live from my home country, Solomon Islands. I'm part of the Pacific Journalism Network, who've been hosting Pacific Beat each Friday in our very own countries. Today on the show, changes to Vanuatu's information laws ring alarm bells for local media. Also, ground handling staff face an uncertain future at Tonga's International Airport.
If the government was to take away the compliant, the certified ground handler from that license, the license would cease to exist.
And contestants enter the final day of Miss Heilala 2025. That and more coming up. I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu Leong, and you're tuning in to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, yours in the Pacific. In the face of calls from around the Pacific for a moratorium or a complete ban, there's a new twist in the ongoing debate over deep-sea mining. Australia's peak scientific body, the CSIRO, has developed the first environmental management and monitoring frameworks that's designed to protect deep-sea ecosystems should the International Seabed Authority allow mining to go ahead. The project was commissioned by the Canadian Exploration Corporation, the Metals Company, and the research findings are based on its test mining activities in international waters known as the Clarion-Clipperton Zone. Lucy Cooper has been talking to the CSIRO's senior principal research scientist, Dr. Piers Dunstan, who says the project sets a new benchmark for environmental assessment.
Our goal and the work that we have done sets a standard for a really robust and rigorous analysis of deep-sea communities and deep-sea mining, so that if deep-sea mining does occur, it'll be underpinned by science-based management and monitoring. I think it's really important to emphasise that this is a scientific analysis of operations that were conducted under licence from the International Seabed Authority, and no more than that. And what is really clear, and really clear across everything, is that we are not doing an environmental impact statement, nor are we doing an environmental management or monitoring plan. Our work is a scientific research programme and is completely limited to that.
What did the research find?
Our results show that there is a connection between, that the connection between the seafloor, the deep ocean and the upper ocean is absolutely critical. Our models and observations suggest that there is separation and a disconnect between these different parts of the ocean in the Clarion-Clipperton Zone and between the upper ocean and the deep ocean zones. And what this means is that we found that the impacts of water returned to the ocean after mining, which is known as the return plume, are really dependent on the depths of discharge and the vertical connectivity. On the seafloor, our research shows that there are substantial local impacts from the effect from different mining operations. In terms of those impacts on the seafloor, we find that seabed mining on marine species changes with different functional groups. So some functional groups are highly impacted and have very long recovery times, and other functional groups are less impacted and may recover over shorter time periods. If mining were to go ahead, we think monitoring of impacts is absolutely critical. It's the first time that this sort of work has occurred in a model that describes ecosystems from the surface all the way down to the seabed. The model does really identify that there are potentially adverse effects within and proximal to the directly mined areas, including substantial changes to the seafloor due to substrate removal and sediment deposition. But one thing that we did see is that no one was able to identify a pathway to go from the seafloor back up to the ocean, to the surface. And so that's an important finding there, that things that occur on the seafloor, at least in the understanding that we have now, are not able to be transmitted up to the surface. As part of our very early work, we looked at what serious harm is And serious harm is a key concern for the International Seabed Authority, and it's the thing that we're all trying to avoid. And we basically worked through and said that there's a limit that should be identified, and provided quite a lot of guidance within this paper that's available on how to calculate that limit, and all the different parts of the ecosystem and different species characteristics and functional group characteristics that should be taken into consideration in order for us to actually be able to calculate what serious harm is. We also identified that there's a point where you want to be more cautious, a threshold between the detectable harm and significant harm. And these sorts of areas are where you would want to start to implement more and more robust ecosystem management processes and/or more monitoring processes to make sure that you never actually cross the threshold into going to serious harm.
Is this relevant given the metals company is going around the International Seabed Authority?
So this is a very relevant, we feel this is a very relevant report. It is the first integrated assessment that anyone's ever done of the deep ocean in this particular way. It's a scientific output that can be applied potentially, not just to the NORI-D lease, but also more broadly, potentially for other operations. And we're certainly making all of our reports and information publicly available so that they can be accessed by anyone.
The metals company says that deep sea mining is a better alternative to land-based mining and therefore should be pursued. Does the CSIRO accept this argument as a reason to mine the seabed?
CSIRO's position is that the regulator for seabed mining is the International Seabed Authority, and it is the responsibility of the International Seabed Authority to make decisions around whether or not mining operations should occur.
Dr. Piers Dunstan, the CSIRO's Senior Principal Research Scientist, and he was talking there to Lucy Cooper. A recent change to Vanuatu's right to information law is causing alarm within the media and among transparency advocates. Parliament has passed an amendment that allows the cabinet to keep all of its decisions secret, a move which critics and opponents alike say underlines the need for democratic accountability. Pacific Beat's reporter in Vanuatu, Lily Rose Wellwell, is following the story and joins us on the line from Port Vila. With that, I say good morning, Lily Rose.
Good morning, Chrissy.
Lovely to hear you this morning. Tell us more about the change to the right to information law in Vanuatu and why it's raising so many concerns.
So, Chrissy, the government of Vanuatu has passed an amendment to its Right to Information Act, adding a new section, Section 40A, which now means that decisions made by the Council of Ministers, the executive arm of government here in Vanuatu, can be kept from public. So this effectively means the public, media, and even some oversight parties can no longer have access to records of cabinet decisions, even when they involve major national policies or public spending. The law first introduced was in 2016, was meant to promote government transparency and accountability. But this latest change has sparked serious concerns from the civil society, journalists, organizations, and even the Office of the Ombudsman, who warn it could undermine those democratic principles.
So, Lily Rose, there are concerns there, but are there people in the media who are prepared to speak out publicly and risk a government backlash?
Yes, and the response has been strong. The Media Association of Vanuatu has expressed disappointment at the lack of consultation. I spoke to the president of the association, Charles Asumbe, and here's what he had to say.
It's very important for the people to know what the outcome of their meetings are, and so to keep track on what is happening in Vanuatu as well. And with the amendment, it also closes the door for the people of Vanuatu to know what the executive or what the decision body has decided moving forward and the reasons behind their decision.
So Charles Sumbe, the president of the Media Association's comment reflect a broader sentiment that people want more clarity and involvement and not less transparency.
Lily Rose, so those are the concerns by the Media Association. But are there others in the community who are weighing in on the issue?
Yes, the concerns aren't limited to journalists. At the recent Right to Information workshop held here in Port Vila, which brought together media professionals, government communication officers, including digital rights advocates, the topic was front and center. The Right to Information unit reminded participants that in the past, even when cabinet met in other islands like Santo and Tana, the decisions were made public. So people are asking, why change that now? People say that tradition of openness should not be abandoned, and one key issue is the delayed release of the Citizenship Commission of Inquiry report and investigation into Vanuatu's citizenship investment scheme. The report is believed to contain politically sensitive findings, and critics are worried that this new amendment now could be used to block the release, to block its release, which the Right to Information unit also pointed out that in the past, even when cabinet have met in other islands, those informations were readily available, including sensitive informations.
And with those concerns from the community as well, is there any possibility, Lily Rose, that the change approved by the parliament could then be reversed?
There is growing pressure. The opposition leader, Ishmael Kalsagau, has called for the amendment to be reviewed. He warned that it could erode accountability, especially in cases involving public funds and national identity, which that has already been happened. So civil society groups are calling for legal clarity. They want a stronger public consultation and for the government to reconsider how this law aligns with Vanuatu's democratic commitments, including the Right to Information Office continues to provide training to civil servants and others so that they can understand the changes and uphold transparency. But the broader concern remains how to you balance national interests with the public's right to know, especially in a small democratic country like Vanuatu, where trust in government is deeply tied to openness. That question is now open and is now front and center in people's mind. People are talking about it. But whether there will be any changes is yet to be seen.
Yes, and trust that that's something that you'll be keeping us up to date in the weeks ahead. But we thank you, Tomas Lily Rose. Thank you, Tomas, for Time Blue. You got a one flag. Good day.
Thank you, Tomas. Krisise Makliu.
That's Lily Rose Well, reporting for Pacific Beat from Port Vila.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favorite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the era to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Kristen Rita Omanu-Leong in Solomon Islands. And there's more drama in Tonga's aviation sector, with questions over the future of ground handling at Fuamotu International Airport in Nuku'alofa. It comes after Tonga's government announced it would not be renewing a license to Airport Air Terminal Services, or ATS, beyond September. It follows months of uncertainty, legal consultations, and national security concerns. But it's put the spotlight on the future of international flights into the kingdom. What impact would this have on international flights and services? Well, Pacific Beat's reporter in Tonga, Marian Kupu, has been speaking to the head of Airport Terminal Services, Paul Karalas, in his first media interview about the standoff.
Our level of certification is such that we have achieved the ASAGO, which is the IATA Safety Audit for Ground Operations, ASAGO, IATA Safety Audit Ground Ops, ASAGO. That's the highest level, and we've achieved that. And it comes after a thorough audit of our ground handling. The other thing is that the ministry itself will also audit us, but generally that's done by the airlines auditing us. So the airlines will have a program where either annually or biannually. If the government was to take away the compliant, the certified ground handler from that license, the license would cease to exist. It would be null and void. And that's the main exercise, that's the main consideration in this whole thing about ground handling. Is that whereas we have now government suggesting that this is for security purposes, that's a security issue. It's not a ground handling issue. The supposition was that Air New Zealand advised that if the ground handler is suspended, then their license is suspended because the ground handling part is part and parcel of their operating certificate. So it's an essential part of it. And so if you take that away, you effectively, it's not that they don't want to operate, it's that they're not allowed to operate. And this is all part of international regulations that first and foremost are for safety of the passengers and so on. And also to protect the aircraft and people and so on, that they have competent people there to do so. And if that's not there, then they would be taking huge risks.
Paul Karalis, head of Airport Terminal Services in Nuku'alofa, and he was talking to Marian Kupu. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, here in the capital of Honiara, the nation's famous trade show is in full swing ahead of Solomon Islands Independence Day on Monday. Trade shows were once synonymous with Independence Day, but the last time one was held here was in 2014. As I found out when I attended this week, there's a sense of excitement around its revival, drawing in thousands of locals to celebrate diversity and culture. It's a hot morning here in the eastern part of Honiara, where thousands of people are gathered here, some still finding their way around. As I look around me, smokes are billowing behind me and a strong distinctive smell of barbecue in the air. The event commemorates Solomon Islands turning 47. I'm here in front of an artificial lake that separates us from the stage where it's day one of the 9-day celebration. It's this defying moment that's bringing back smiles from the Happy Isles. And tell me your name again. You just came and you started dancing and I wasn't able to get a hold of your name.
This is my stall. Yeah. So my name is Ruth Barrio. Looking forward to share knowledge with women and other entrepreneurs. I already share with them. And I said that this is one of the important goals for our government, that we need to grow, we need to expand, and we need to take our business also to other countries.
Are you going to do another dance now?
Sure. No. That should be enough for me.
We're trying to find some shade here at the event, and with me here we have a Solomon Islander who is also part of the celebrations. Hello, can you tell me your name?
My name is Dudley Longame. I am the managing director of Kubonitu Holding Limited, that if more do with the cover buying and exporting business. So I am coming here to this trade fair show to be one of the participants and to participate with this trade fair and to showcase my products and to show to disseminate information to my farmers as well.
this whole trade show after 11 years. It's now back in place. Were you part of the last one? And what do you think about having this trade fair again?
Yeah, it's really a long time, way back in 2014. And now we really missed these kinds of opportunity to showcase our products. We really find, as a private sector in Solomon Island, we really find it difficult to connect ourselves with the farmers, with the government, because we have geographical locations in the islands of farmers and the businesses. So when this trade fair show established again here this year, 2035, we're really happy and appreciate that this sort of trade fair show is very important for us to showcase and to let our people know, because our people are mostly residing at the remote places. So now it's time for them to come and then we to show and to pass information to them so that we may improve supply.
How do you feel to be able to celebrate another independent celebrations on Monday?
Yeah, as a Solomon Islander, I'm very feel happy that it's a marks another milestone for us because it's to do with the transformation that we are coming through the difficulties, the challenges that we're facing through the ethnic tensions and riots and all these problems. When we celebrate this year, independent celebration, marks a new roadmap for us, a new way forward for us to link the peaceful business sectors, peaceful environment.
Thank you, Thomas, for time to you.
Thank you, Thomas.
Right under this tree here, I've found two mothers who are part of this. I'll ask them to introduce themselves. Hello, Tupala. If you can tell me your name.
Yes, my name is Hilda.
My name is Madeline.
Yes. What brings you here to this event?
Me happy for come long.
I'm so happy to be part of the celebrations. I'm here to look and listen to what ways we can work together to help better the country.
This country, Solomon Island.
And what about yourself?
I'm happy to be part of this as well. I came with my daughter as it's school holidays.
What do you think about the journey where country has taken over the years?
Me happy that and hope that this country will grow.
It's overwhelming, especially with the number of people out here. You can feel a sense of togetherness and pride in the crowd. In a country of close to a million, you can see a fraction of it are gathered here, quite uncertain of what happens next in their country, but hoping that 47 years of independence can be a time of learning and progressing into a future that is brighter for Solomon Islanders. Those were the voices of some Solomon Islanders who I had met at the start of the trade show. Independence Day is on Monday and you can tune in to Pacific Beat for all the latest on how Solomon Islanders are marking this day. The non-government organization Act Now has poured cold water on Prime Minister James Marape's announcement that no more forestry licenses will be approved in Papua New Guinea after September 16th, the 50th anniversary of the country's independence. Mr. Marape issued his statement during a meeting of the Green Climate Fund Board in Port Moresby, where he urged the international community to work together to save the world's oceans and rainforests. However, successive governments have been promising to stop logging in PNG since 2010. But none has delivered, leading Act Now's campaign manager Eddie Tanago to suggest that the Prime Minister's proclamation is likely to go the same way.
It's a concern, you know, when you have a Prime Minister making such promises, because, you know, the promises of doing away with logging, doing away with issuance of licenses dates back to 2010. The issues that are within the sector is also as old as Papua New Guinea. If you remember the Bennett Commission of Inquiry in 1989, 1987, 1989, specifically highlights issues of money laundering, tax evasion, issues of lack of prior and informed consent from the resource or landowners. And those issues were highlighted back then. It's even to this date, we are still talking about the same issues that we're talking about. And money laundering happens to be a very big issue. It is why Papua New Guinea is we're heading towards being grey listed. So, and the logging sector very much contributes to that grey listing as well. So with this kind of promises that the Prime Minister is making, is we're not really, really sure as to how that's going to happen. We don't really trust what he's saying at the moment, because we have seen in the past repeated promises made on official documents and on even on, you know, such promises made already. And on the eve of the independence, we are seeing the Prime Minister talking about ending giving licenses to new companies. And it's all the repeated promises that we've seen all over the years.
We have the Internal Revenue Commission boss who has actually said that the tax evasion issues, which are very much current in the logging sector. And if the Prime Minister is really, really serious about this kind of issues, then he has to take action. He has to walk the talk, not just any public statement made in the eve of our 50th birthday. You know, now Papua New Guinea is now going into potentially going to be grey listed. And the logging sector itself plays a huge role in Papua New Guinea being grey listed. And it is a huge, huge, huge concern for a country that's turning 50 years now.
When you say grey listed, what's that?
Grey listed means that, you know, Papua New Guinea is currently not stable in terms of the issues on money laundering. It's not an environment that is conducive for business. So we have this global body that looks at in-country compliance in terms of issues on money laundering. So Papua New Guinea is now headed towards that. There have been a couple of recommendations made towards Papua New Guinea to ensure that certain steps are taken to ensuring us Papua New Guinea not going into that direction. And unfortunately, we are headed into it, and it's towards the end of the year now. And Papua New Guinea's got a very small gap or time frame to ensure that we are not headed towards that direction, which is not going to be good for businesses, not going to be good for companies to operate in country, and an environment that is conducive for businesses. And the local sector has a lot to do with this as well too.
If landowners were totally in charge of their land, what sort of positive impact will that bring for their families as well as the economy? Then I hear you mentioned Isipik and Bougainville landowners who are currently involved in agriculture businesses.
That is a model that's already working for the people. And come 50th anniversary now, it's time for us, those in authority, the government, the policymakers, decision makers, to reflect back and look at where we were. What has the Constitutional Fathers said about our development path? What did the Constitutional Planning Committee said when they first sat down to discuss Papua New Guinea's independence and its economic pathway? Where have we gone wrong? And we have living, breathing examples that show that Papua New Guineans can become very, very successful businessmen and women if they can hold on to their land. And the role of the government is to provide the infrastructure, provide the extension services, and most importantly, to provide the market. We've seen currently now in Isipik, in Bougainville, the cocoa prices has skyrocketed, and the people have actually brought their produce to the market, and they're selling it at higher prices. They're getting maximum benefit out of it, and the monies are not leaving the country. It's kept in the people's pocket, and that is the kind of model we want promoted. That is the kind of pathway we want. We want development that, you know, benefits the people. We want people at the center of development. It's not about promoting foreign-owned corporations who are only here to make profit. And when they make profits, you know, these big companies, they have bank accounts hidden in tax havens, places where you do not know how transactions happen. They're all hidden. They're all hidden and are kept secret. So profits are hidden there. They're taken abroad and put them in places like Singapore, Hong Kong. And while we as people, so-called resource owners and landowners, we are given the bones to fight over, while the meat is taken away also and hidden somewhere else. So if you look at it, it's about time now for the government to look at, really look at our development path. Where have we gone wrong? Where can we fix things? So this is the kind of reflection that we should be doing holistically come our 50th anniversary now.
Are you saying that in these 50 years of independence, there has not been any downstream processing at all in PNG?
Downstream processing, most of our resources are brought in from outside. We are more of a country that is dependent on resources brought from outside. It's very, very limited in downstream processing. Just imagine if we created everything or produced everything in country. It stops the issue. It stops the money going out of the country. It stops businesses from buying from outside. In a way, we keep the money within the country. So, yes, in terms of downstream processing, it's a very big area that also the government needs to look at it. And this needs to be taken into consideration where downstream processing becomes part of the country as well.
PNG's Act Now campaign manager, Eddie Tanago, speaking there to Caroline Tiriman. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu-Leong, coming to you live from Solomon Islands. Well, it's time to switch to sport now, where the OFC Women's Nations Cup kicks off in Lautoka later today. And with New Zealand once again opting out of the tournament, there's a chance for another island nation to follow Papua New Guinea by etching their name onto the trophy. History ranks PNG as the Queens of the Pacific after a succession of Pacific Games gold medals, and then in 2022, they defeated Fiji 2-1 to win the Nations Cup for the first time. But since that landmark win, the Lakatoys have had some turbulent times, culminating in a recent home defeat to Fiji. And as Richard Ewart reports, the Kulas are now considered favourites by many to be crowned 2025 champions.
The national women's soccer team from Papua New Guinea are not used to being beaten by any of their Pacific rivals, and certainly not on home soil. So the recent 3-2 loss in a friendly international against Fiji came as a shock. Now, coach Erickson Komang says they have to pick themselves up to compete in Group A at the OFC Nations Cup, where they'll be up against Samoa, Tahiti and Cook Islands.
Fiji came here with a good side and they did well, so it's going to be tough for us, but we keep working hard and we're looking forward for the tournament. We have a tough pool. We won't take any team lightly. They are good in their own right, so we just have to concentrate on ourselves and be competitive.
Women's soccer is on a roll in Samoa, with their under-17s heading to the FIFA World Cup later in the year, and two of the players from that highly successful side have been drafted into coach Juan Chang Uria's senior squad.
We definitely are taking this opportunity for girls to grow in the game and to make Samoa proud. We understand it's a top pool, everyone is there to win it, but to have two of our under-17 girls here with us is pretty exciting for the country, for everyone to watch them play.
Assembling a team has proved tricky for Tahiti's coach, Xavier Samar. He's had to navigate his way around his players' school and work commitments just to bring his squad together.
I have students who are taking exams right now, so I've had a hard time getting them together. Also, I have players who work in private companies, and it's difficult for them too to get time off work and leave the country to travel to Fiji.
The fourth team in Group A, Cook Islands, is the only one to have a female coach at the helm in Angela Wallbank, herself a former international. She says the experience gained from those players in the Tupapa side who represented Cook Islands in the OFC Champions League back in May will be very valuable.
We've really been pushing it for the girls to be able to not only increase their game awareness, but also understand the fundamentals of football a little bit more so that we can do things like be a bit quicker in transition. And it's been a long time since the women's team has really, truly competed at a Nations Cup, but I know that they can.
And she says her side will be made all the stronger by the arrival of her overseas-based contingent.
One of the key things for us is going to be integrating the overseas players into the selection of the local players. But I think if we play our game, we're going to go far. What's to note, though, is those teams are physically tough. They can play football and they can score goals. So we're countering all of that and setting ourselves up for being able to do the same.
In Group B, Solomon Islands' Moses Tuata has a different view of the Champions League because several of his squad had to leave camp to take part, including star player Eileen Peggy. Now, coach Tuata is wrestling with that age-old question: which came first, the chicken or the egg?
I'm not counting any eggs yet because I know that the pool we are in is tough. We have Tonga who have performed really well recently. Also Fiji, for me, is the team to beat. They have a very good squad and they prepared really well. And so I'm expecting a really tough encounter with all the teams.
Tonga's coach, Kilifi Ueli, says he started preparations with his squad as soon as the country's domestic league season was over. And while clearly he'd love his team to win the OFC tournament, his focus is on climbing the regional and world ladder.
We send all our invitation for all the local players and the overseas-based player. My expectation is for us to increase our ranking, FIFA ranking and the OFC ranking. We are fifth, but we tuck in the semi-final with this, the top four.
3 years ago, Vanuatu were very unlucky to miss out on a semi-final spot with yellow cards rather than results or goals preventing them from moving on. Once again, coach Jean-Robert Yalou is relying on a home-based squad, but he concedes lack of experience outside Vanuatu does put his team at a disadvantage.
I have good players, but really they don't play in professional or semi-professional or play in the other countries. All my players, they just play local league.
And so do Fiji, tournament hosts once again, and the only team in their group with a female coach in Angeline Chua, the former Singapore international who cut her coaching teeth with the Seychelles. Having led her team to victory over PNG just last month, she's keen to fit in more matches outside tournaments and has more than half an eye on the biggest prize of all.
During the international window, many teams in the world is playing. So for us, we are thinking a bit far in terms of the FIFA World Cup 2027, where we have 1.5 spot and we have to play other confederation, you know, if we are ambitious enough to think about the 0.5 spot. Of course, we have the home pressure that, you know, Fiji likes to win. And of course, we are thinking about winning the gold medal.
And just to boost their chances even more in the IFC Nations Cup, Fiji's best-known player is back with the squad from FC Olympia in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I think one of the players that has been absent for a while is Trina Davis. The fans love her, you know, in terms of her interaction and her play. So we are very excited to have Trina back.
Fiji's first match will be against Solomon Islands tomorrow evening, but the tournament kicks off with two games in Group A later today, with Tahiti versus Cook Islands first up, to be followed by Samoa against the defending champions, Papua New Guinea.
Richard Ewart looking ahead at the action to come over the next 2 weeks in the OFC Women's Nations Cup, with the final scheduled to be played on July 19th in Suva.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We go to Palau now, where baseball might be the most popular sport at the Pacific Mini Games. However, basketball is not far behind. But it's not the traditional game being played right now in Palau. It's the smaller format, the 3x3, which only allows teams to field three players on the court at one time. Not surprisingly, regional rivalries, particularly among the Micronesian nations, are strong. But as Palau women's player Tomoe Sungino told Kyle Evans, this year there is something extra to play for.
The teams that win the final game, or let's say the gold medal game, will qualify directly into the World Cup. Throughout the whole tournament, there's 12 teams, and they're split into two conferences, Oceania 1 and Oceania 2. And then within those conferences, there's 6 teams. And then each day, they're split into 3 for 2 pools within each conference, and they'll play each other during the day. At the end of each day, there's a final. They're basically just mini tournaments. At the end, whoever wins is basically the winner of the whole Oceania because they completed each stop.
Yeah, interesting. So it sounds like it's almost a bit of an endurance-based game because you play so often. Does that make it harder or easier than the traditional basketball format, do you think?
3x3 is definitely a very fast-paced game compared to 5x5, where you have more teammates to play with and rely on. It can be very mentally and physically exhausting.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, Guam and Fiji are typically the dominant teams in traditional basketball. That was definitely the case at the Pacific Games in 2023, which I attended. Is that the case in 3x3 as well?
Guam and Fiji are very strong teams, but as I said, 3x3 is a very fast-paced game and anything can happen. Personally, I think like 3x3 is height is not very... height is not so much as an advantage. Palau men's team is putting on a show and upsetting Fiji.
What about the women? How have you guys gone?
This tournament is, it does have an age restriction. It was implemented very last minute. So a lot of the girls that were already trying out in the beginning weren't able to qualify because they were still underage. So our team is a very premature last minute team. I was flying in from Australia. Another teammate of mine came in from Taiwan. So we only had like 2 weeks to practice with each other, and that's not a lot of time.
No.
So we're still kind of getting our groove and establishing that team chemistry that we don't have yet. We did win a game yesterday, but a lot more games to play.
Palau does have a bit of an American influence, and I know baseball is very, very popular. Where does basketball stack up in terms of popularity in Palau?
I feel like basketball is also very popular, not as popular as baseball since it is our national sport. I think the running joke here is basketball is usually Palau and Guam. That's like a rivalry that has been going on. But it is pretty popular, but as of right now, there's not a lot of programs happening.
Why do you think that is? Is it like a lack of infrastructure or a lack of funding or just a lack of interest?
I think it'll start off as lack of funding from the federation, and then that's lack of sticks or people that can run the tournament or run events for the youth.
And just finally, before we go, you mentioned that the men were obviously doing well. Do you think they can win the tournament?
I believe in my men's team. You know, they're playing really hard. They're hustling hard. They're working hard on defense, and they're making their shots. And three of them it's their first time as a national team with the experienced team captain, Jerry. And I think if they just keep playing the way they've been playing, then you know they can secure the win in our conference, and then hopefully move on to the final game against whoever wins the Oceania 2 conference. As for the women, Fiji is a pretty strong team in the Oceania 1 conference. And then you got Tonga, the strongest in their conference too, with the back-to-back wins in the Stop 1 and Stop 2 finals. So I think those two teams are heading towards the end. But as I said, anything can happen in 3x3. A lot of upsets have been happening. So we'll just see how that goes.
Palau women's basketballer Tomoe Sungino speaking with Kyle Evans, and she will be back in action today for two games against PNG and Vanuatu before returning to the court again on Monday. Meanwhile, Tahiti remains atop the medal count with a commanding 75 medals, 43 of which are gold. Samoa are currently in second place with 31 medals. And that, of course, brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, Australia's peak scientific body, the CSIRO, has developed the first environmental frameworks to protect deep sea ecosystems from mining.
It sets a standard for a really robust and rigorous analysis so that if deep sea mining does occur, it'll be underpinned by science-based management and monitoring.
Dr. Piers Dunstan, the CSIRO's Senior Principal Research Scientist, speaking there. We'll be back again same time on Monday. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. I'm Kristen Rita Omanuliang from Honiara. Have a great day.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favourite podcast app to listen.